Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's very nice to welcome you all here to this Sales Lunchtime seminar. I have the honour and privilege of welcoming Nina Berger from the University of Bristol. And Nina's done some really interesting work on the social aspect of the EU's questions of solidarity. And she's now moved into the field of a method of coordination and new governance. And she's actually looking at how new governance actually works on the ground rather than just philosophising about the marvellous way that OMC could work in theory. And so I will leave the floor to her to explain whether it's functioning or not and how it's functioning. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Catherine, for introducing me and for having me here. If you can't hear me at the back, then please do let me know and I'll try and raise my voice. What I'm going to talk about is a research project that is in the relatively early stages at the moment. It's funded by the AHRC, by the Arts and Humanities Research Council, and it'll run until next December. I'm conducting this with somebody from Middlesex University. The title of our project is Making Europe in Their Image, Communities of Expertise and the Shaping of EU Governance. And in a broad sweep, the area this project is located in is the area of new governance, which I'm sure most of you will have touched on or are even working in. Those who are working in this field, I'd be very appreciative of any comments, of course. So, the aim of our project really is to interrogate existing accounts of new governance structures, to look at the way in which new governance, and I'll come to define that in a moment, develops institutionally. How do we get from the beginning of a new governance system in the EU to a more established new governance structure? That's the broad sweep of our project. So it looks at the institutional development. New governance what does it mean? Well, it describes softer forms of transnational coordination in EU regulation. Rather than looking at harmonised legislative developments, the implementation of a directive, the legislation of a regulation and so on and so forth, new governance structures have emerged in a whole range of areas, from environment to social welfare to food safety and so on and so forth, where softer forms of disciplining take place within the context and alongside more established institutional structures of the EU. One manifestation, so the idea being there is national experimentation, a lot of discretion at the national level, and then not hard law at the European level, but a softer form of benchmarking, peer review, and disciplining. One element that recurs in those structures is the idea of a transnational network. People who sit on those networks are officials from the member states. So, for instance, people from the regulator for telecoms, people from the regulator for medicines, that come from the member states, that get together and compare notes on how things are best regulated in their field of expertise in their member states. That comparing notes is the process that new governance is all about. It's not about what is the best solution that these networks talk about, but it's about peer reviewing what possible solutions there can be and then benchmarking solutions that can be improvements to the individual individual suggestions. It's not about finding one right solution. So the first step, really, in our study is to scope the emergence or scope the range of new governance and network structures in the EU. When we looked at the literature there, there's a whole new sort of body of work that has emerged, really. And there's a recent, very interesting book by Jonathan Zeitlin and Charles Sable, who've worked in this field for quite a long time, that really give you an idea, and it was published by OUP in 2010, and that book really gives you an idea of the broad range of these more networked, less hard law, and more new governance structures for those who are interested. So the first step for us is really scoping how and where does new governance take place. Well, there are sort of broadly two types of scenario that you might think of. The first scenario is you get a directive, you get an EU competence, for instance, in the area of telecoms regulation. In order to implement that directive, you don't specify exactly the way how it is implemented, but you leave a lot of discretion to national authorities. That discretion, that room that is then left to national authorities, is filled with coordinative structures. That's how the networks develop. So that's one large type typology of one type of new governance structures that you find in areas such as the privatized utilities, public health and safety, environmental structures, and so on and so forth. Sorry. Then on the other side of the spectrum, you get areas in which the EU has not got any competence to pass hard laws. So it cannot pass directives. These are the core areas of social welfare, economic policy coordination, and also political prerogatives such as justice and security. In those areas, the scenario is slightly different, although the boundaries are, of course, blurred. The EU cannot act by hard law, and that's where the coordinative, softer network structure steps in. The typical example for that being the open method of coordination, where you don't have any hard powers, for instance, in the area of employment policy and social policy. You don't have any hard powers, but you have a rather structured form of coordinating that is overseen by the EU institutions, the Commission and the Council. Yeah? So that's just the scoping exercise, really. Now, central question for us is, how do these structures develop from something that emerges, maybe by accident, maybe by design, into something that is actually institutionally sanctioned by the EU institution? Something that is taken into the institutional fold of the EU and develops into something that actually operates alongside the more traditional modes of integration with the sanctioning of the EU institutions. So that's the institutional timeline we're looking at, or the institutional line we're looking at. When we looked at existing explanations or accounts for these developments, we found that most of them explain the emergence of policy networks or new governance structures exogenously, meaning that they focused on the member states and also to some extent the EU institutions willing these structures into being. So the process was one where member states or also the EU institutions, allowed these structures to develop, and in some instances also positively encouraged them to develop. I'll come to the actual explanations in a moment, but what fascinated us was that there was very little work done on the actors that sit on those networks and how they influence the institutional development and ripening of these structures. So we wanted to look at things from a more endogenous perspective and look at really how the officials that sit on those networks, those national officials, influence questions about institutional change. Now, what are the existing accounts that have been given? We've kind of found three broad strands, really. The first, and the one that is most common, really, in the literature, especially on the open method of coordination, and those who will have worked with that will be well familiar with that literature. It's really an intergovernmental account. New governance and policy networks are described as an attempt to resolve an asymmetry in the EU's regulatory architecture. They are described as means for member states to, at the one hand, address a collective action problem where member states find in an area they really need to get together. Otherwise, for instance, such as social welfare, they need to find some way of coordinating their policies. Otherwise, deep inefficiencies will emerge. But on the other hand, member states very, very carefully guarding their national sovereignty in those fields. So without giving up their ultimate sovereignty, but also conceding somewhat to the functional dilemma, they agree and they will into being a network that coordinates somewhat, but also leaves enough room for national experimentation and discretion. So that's the intergovernmental account. Then a second strand of the literature focuses not so much on the member states moving these things forward, but actually on the EU, and particularly the EU Commission itself. Network structures can be quite useful to the Commission. They tend to be rather, or in a lot of areas, rather depoliticized creatures. So, for instance, the issue of telecoms regulation, how do we want to regulate telecoms in the national market, becomes something that is talked about within a group of experts that meets at the supranational level, but those experts are not political actors. There are experts in market regulation. Now, those structures can be convenient for the Commission if it sees that there is no more scope for harmonisations. Member states are not going to give way. They're not going to go any further than that. So the Commission says, well, we go at least this far, and at least we establish a network that we, as the Commission, then can influence as well as interact with. So is the Commission really, from this point of view, that drives some of these networks forward, not only as a second best solution to harmonization often, but also as a conscious decision of depoliticizing certain areas in the long run, and through that depoliticization, getting more influence and also sucking up the expertise of those networks. That's the supranational account. And then a third type of explanation that we came across in this field focuses on processes of diffusion and modeling. So here the idea is really that once you get softer forms of disciplining or network structure. In more and more areas of regulation, of governance, ranging from welfare to freedom, justice and security, the more they emerge, the more normal they become. The more they become the thing to do in terms of regulation, and the more that model of regulation, that model of transnational coordination will be emulated. As I said before, these are exogenous accounts. The focus here is on, in the explanation, on who has the hard power. Is it the member state? Is it the commission? Or is it them two working together in a sort of modelling process? Now, shifting to the other perspective, the literature we looked at, to the perspective of a more endogenous analysis, the literature we looked at here really led us quite far away from the legal realm. We had to go quite deep into some of the political science literature, or we are going quite deep into some of the political science literature, and the starting point really is historical institutionalism here. Historical institutionalism really conceives of institutional developments as something that is very much driven by the actors themselves. There is no grand design in the integration process for the historical institutionalist. But there are rather small steps in a process that is driven by the actors that sit in the process themselves and also the institutions that sit in the process themselves and itself. So what institutionalism really suggests is that we really need to understand how actors work. How do they work directly? But also, how do they work indirectly or entrepreneurially by influencing other actors and getting them to do things? In more concrete terms, if you have a network of officials or experts that is fairly established in a particular field and has a fair amount of influence over policies, well, how do they use that influence over the institutions with the hard power to also develop institutionally structures that manifest their position more firmly? So from that perspective, we found that really we can build up a hypothesis that looks at networks and their institutional changes from a more endogenous perspective. I should also say that, of course, what we're not trying to do is to discredit any of the other accounts of new governance and any of the other explanations that have been given. Of course, the intergovernmental account that I outlined is still an absolutely valid account of how things work in the field of new governance. And the fact that states create the framework conditions for a new governance structure or a more soft form of disciplining to emerge still remains the case. But what we're suggesting is that the endogenous perspective needs to be added as a supplementary explanation. Whilst you have the framework conditions to give a trajectory of new governance or whatever you want to call it, you then, once you have that, once you're at that stage, you really need to also look at what the actors themselves are doing. To what extent does the network itself and the governance process become self-reinforcing? That's the that really is the sort of theoretical the theoretical positioning that we've taken, and how we reach that hypothesis. Now, just as a next step, really, we look at a little bit more carefully at how the process of communities of expertise that sit in new governance structures, how the process of them influencing institutional structures, how that actually works. So I'm just going to say a little bit more about that and then talk about our case study for a few minutes, and I think that'll be enough. Communities of expertise are what we call the, whether you want to name them officials or simply members, of the networks that we've identified in the various areas. Now, what marks these as communities and why are they relevant? They are marked as communities because the people sitting on them have very similar backgrounds, even though they come from various different member states. I'll give you an example. In the field of telecoms, you now have a directive that requires member states to have independent national regulators. Who sits on those regulators? Well, different types of people. Sometimes they will come from the ministry. Sometimes they will be have an industry background and so on and so forth. Fact is that they will be professionally trained in a very narrow field of expertise, if you want. And I don't mean narrow in a negative sense. I mean it simply in a factual sense. So where they're coming from, and this goes across the board in all member states, they're shaped by the perception and by the background that has formed them. And that's important because that sort of is the glue, if you want, that binds them together, and also that binds their belief, potentially, I'm talking hypothetically, in a certain way of doing things. And that way of doing things is, if you want, a fairly scientific kind of way. So if national telecoms regulators come together in a network, which exists now in the EU, they will not want to talk about deeply political things, although, of course, what they're talking about is political, but the political things they will discuss with their ministry. What they're doing is talking to other scientific experts, in this case, about very specific solutions to apolitical questions, namely, how do we regulate this market most effectively? That's the kind of difference that exists within the communities of expertise, and comparing that to more political forums. Why is that relevant? Because potentially they will want that kind of interaction also to be replicated at the European level when they talk to each other transnationally and when they make decisions transnationally. So the form of a form of more collegiate interaction, if you want, is what they're used to in their informal interactions with other experts, and that then becomes transposed and again, willed into being, transposed to a more structural level at the EU level in the form of a more structured network. That network, as I said before, doesn't make hard law decisions, it makes soft decisions. But that is exactly the kind of interaction that the communities of expertise and the officials operating in them are used to or are practicing at the national level. So that's why the communities of expertise here are relevant. How do they exert their influence institutionally? Well, they need to act through soft power. They don't have hard power to change any institutional structures. They don't have the hard power to turn themselves into a more structured network, but they have power of expertise over their national governments, whose advisors they are. They have a wealth of expertise that puts them in a good position also against the Commission. So really, what they will be doing and this is a hypothesis again, what they will be doing, if this hypothesis is direct, they will use that soft power, that expertise, and that positioning right at the heart of where regulation is happening to also influence how institutional structures develop from A to B. So we're not moving, if it is in accordance with their terms, we're not moving from a network structure to a more centralized structure at some point. We're moving from an informal network structure to a more structured and sanctioned network structure. That's the hypothetical dynamic that we're looking at. Of course, you can take that dynamic and try and look for it in a lot of areas. The area we've chosen for now is quite a narrow one. It is precisely the area of telecoms, where you've got a very elaborate framework of telecoms regulation set up by various framework directives. You have also got a fairly established community of expertise in the form of a transnational network of telecoms regulators by now. That used to be called the ERG. Now it is something that has actually been sanctioned in the latest directive. In 2009, the directive was reviewed and so on and so forth. Rather than moving from a network, the framework allowed and took account of and actually provided for more powers to be conferred on the network of regulators. Now, what we're looking at is the negotiations that led up to that change. And we're asking the question, exactly who influenced that move from a more informal network to a more structured network? How much influence did the actual regulators that were already operative as a more informal network previously, how much influence did the regulators via their national governments exert over the EU institutions? Not in a sort of conspiracy theory way, and if you want. We're not being in any way negative or positive about that process. We're simply looking at it from a factual perspective to see how that particular community of expertise managed to exert its soft power to achieve a particular institutional outcome. And that hopefully, eventually, even though it is a very narrow case study for the time being, that hopefully eventually will contribute something to explain processes of new governance and the emergence and the entrenchment of more networked structures in the EU in some fields. So my question to you really, of course I'm open to every sort of comment, but my question to you would be, in the various fields that you work or that you're interested in, is there anywhere where you can actually see similar processes potentially emerging? Thank you.